Today's guest is Steve Martin, the other Steve Martin. I'm the other one. Together, both of us are all of the other Steve Martins. The occasion for this visit, his third, is the imminent release of the Broadway musical Bright Star cast album. Its connection to the previous two albums that were put out by Steve Martin and Edie Brickell first, Love Has Come For You, and then So Familiar. Somewhere in between there, the genesis of this idea for the musical came about, and now the musical is on Broadway, and now the cast album, which is available to download, is out. So I thought, well, this would be a good chance to talk to Steve again and kind of go through that process of how this thing came to be, how this concept of trading music and lyrics back and forth between Steve and Edie Brickell gave this little seed to what became this incredible Broadway musical, Bright Star. We're going to have a nice visit. I welcome Steve Martin back to Unreal Bluegrass. Steve, how are you today?
Feeling really good.
Good, good.
Just got nominated for 7 Drama Desk Awards.
Well, yeah, that was for the Bright Star musical. One of the reasons that I wanted to catch up with you again is the cast album is due, I think, May 27th. I've listened to it a few times just as it streams on NPR, and I thought, well, we should probably talk about this because it's related to the Love Has Come For You and also the So Familiar album that you did with Edie.
Absolutely. They all tie up rather neatly.
One of the things that is amazing to me is, we've talked about this before, when Love Has Come For You, this little seed of an idea that you have with Edie where you're going to try out and send her some music and then she writes words back, somewhere in that process is born this other entity that winds up being Bright Star, the musical.
Right.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
To me, I just think that none of that was anticipated. As I recall, you weren't even really sure you were going to record an album as such, and all of a sudden you've got these ideas bouncing around, and I believe, if I'm correct, somewhere within that first Love Has Come For You comes this idea of this story that then becomes Bright Star. Is that correct?
Well, it really began with Edie and I having when we were touring on a bus, you have spend a lot of time with a person, and also with the band. The band's on the bus, too. And we discussed how much we loved the musicals we grew up with, which in her case was The Sound of Music, and for me it was Music Man in Oklahoma and West Side Story, and how much they meant to us. And we felt our songs, just kind of looking objectively at them, were melodic, which is one thing those songs have. And so we just started thinking around for an idea. And then we hit upon it. And we just, we didn't look back. We just kept writing and writing and writing. It's on Broadway right now with these nominations. And it's been a total of 4 years to get it together. So, we got great people involved, a great orchestrator, a great arranger, and a fantastic cast and director. So, it's really a collaborative effort doing a musical.
The number of cuts that I see on the cast album, I count at 23. Well, I will tell you that 10 of these, I'm familiar with the tunes, if not explicitly, or at least there's a renamed version. But the rest of these things then were, I see 8 from So Familiar, from Love Has Come For You, Asheville. I believe the interlude portion that you played is the pinnacle.
Love
is,
Asheville.
Yeah.
Recall it as being 8. I kept thinking it was there's Asheville and there's Sun's Gonna Shine.
Well,
I don't recall any
from So Familiar.
So Familiar. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That
yeah.
was already in the show. That was already in the show. Recorded it on a record.
That's
so
right.
You're right. It's backwards a bit. Those were in the show first, except for those two. They were in the show first, and then we decided to record.
Boy,
actually,
right.
To sort of get the public familiar, because I love it in a musical when you're, watching the show, and then something familiar comes along. It's really a nice experience.
Am I right that the interlude, what I would call the interlude, the intermission piece, is that your old banjo tune from way back?
It is. It's a tune I've been playing for a long, long time on stage. And we used to just do it as a banjo tune, and it never had a title. And then I gave it to Edie, and she came up with some lyrics, and the song became Jimmy Ray.
That's right.
Jimmy Ray, and that was in the music for a while, but then we changed it with a different song, and we decided to keep the bluegrass instrumental version in the show as the entr'acte, meaning that's it's what you play between the acts.
Right. And then another round, which I've always kind of, which I think I've heard two recordings of, one live and then on the new So Familiar, the words have changed a little bit because I think that's what's now on the Bright Star musical. That's become, on the musical, that's become like a Texas swing sound.
Yes, and it was in the musical as a bluegrass song for a long time. And the character who sang it was the character played a sister, and I'm not talking about the actress, I'm talking about the character, and we cut the character. So then, you know, we loved the song so much that we found another character who could sing it, but in order to make it logical in the play, it wouldn't have been a bluegrass version, and it would have been this kind of country swing, you know, because it's 1945
right.
in Nashville.
That's right.
So. And that was I felt that was successful. We were happy to do that because both Edie and I love Bob Wills, the Texas Playboy.
Oh yeah, well it worked out nice. I kept thinking, well, that's a nice treatment for that song. And so many of these tunes that even the ones that I'm familiar with, I may miscount them here or there, but the treatment of them, of course, for the Broadway purposes, is something wholly other. I mean, they are you know, you certainly recognize the melodies, but and then this will give you a chance to talk about the voices and the voicings that are involved. It's just they're just some really listening to this, and I've not seen it, but listening to the soundtrack or the cast album, the voices are just so overwhelmingly solid. Every
we
one
do
of
have
them.
Fantastic voices, especially Carmen Cusack. In fact, we put a special cut on the album of her singing "The Sun's Gonna Shine Just Alone" with the chorus. But you know, in the musical, a lot of different voices have a lot of different lines. But we loved her interpretation of it so much, we just put that on there as a kind of a bonus track, I guess.
And now, we've talked about this before, and you always felt very, well, I think you feel very privileged in all the people that are in it, but she was one that you were especially tickled with being able to get her into this program and into the, and getting her working
through. Are you talking about Carmen?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, Carmen turned out to be just like finding gold. She sent in an audition tape on VHS. That's how long we've been working on it, and we really liked her, and it was just for a reading, and she has stayed with the musical now for 4 years, and now it's she just got nominated for Best Actress in a Musical from the Drama Desk. She got nominated Best Actress in a Musical from the Outer Critics Circle, from the other one doesn't have that category, but so she's really emerged from this.
Do you think, and I think listening to the cast album, and I never heard her when you were working it out up east and you went to San Diego, is she getting stronger? Is her voice getting more confident and stronger?
It is. First, it was never lacking. It only just started great and then got better. And she has an amazing voice. I mean, if you listen to a song on there called At Last, At Long Last, you can really hear her soar. And actually, that song was written so she could show off her voice a bit and also stay in the emotional range of the show.
I've seen clips of her, you know, when you have performed on different shows and done and brought bits of the music to it. And she has such a there's a wonderful, it's not just the red hair color, but I mean, there's a wonderful warmth to her personality, and she just seems to really beam as she sings. You know what I mean?
Yeah, she's a very nice person. And there's an article in the New York Times this Sunday, talking about how the story of Bright Star sort of parallels her own life, which is very interesting.
Oh, well, I'll get that because I get that delivered and I'll read that. The tune Sarah Jane and the Iron Mountain Baby, that doesn't appear in the musical. Was that an early germ of an idea?
Well, that was the source of inspiration for what the musical was going to be about. It was based on a news item that Edie discovered about a baby in 1904 that had been discovered in a suitcase by a river that had been thrown from a train. But we thought this was a good story to tell because they never figured out what happened with that story. And this is our Bright Star is a, you know, surrounds that event with characters and events and events leading up and and the aftermath of that event.
It really is.
We had the song Bright Star. I mean, had the song Sarah Jane and the Iron Mountain Baby in there for a long time, and then we realized, wait a minute, it's telling the story that we're already telling.
That's the point I was going to make. I was wondering if that was a decision because it actually winds up being a capsule of the story that you're telling, and not exactly that way, but you're using it as a springboard.
Yeah, and we had, even when we had it in, it was kind of shoehorned in because, you know, when you first start, you kind of shoehorn things in. You go, well, that's a good song. Let's see if we can get that in. And then you start writing new songs that are more appropriate and, That's when the fun began.
Well, I kept thinking back that might have been the springboard, and I knew we talked about it, and then you listen to the whole thing, and then I thought it can't be in there as a separate song because it's kind of like, you know, if you wanted to have a written libretto of the play, you could have the lyrics to
Sarah Jane. Right. Well, actually, the lyrics to Sarah Jane and the Iron Mountain Baby don't reflect our story at all. It only reflects that a baby was thrown from a train, and then, you know, Needy went off and told a lot of different stories.
Okay.
You know, fantasized about what it could have been, but it didn't get into the musical at all. The little stories in that song.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. Well, let's see. I need to see it so I can make sure I can figure those things out. And it's at the Court Theater. The play is still at the musical is at the Court Theater.
Yes. Right.
Which now this is, you know, for the public that may be more accustomed to. Nothing wrong with the giant productions and the things that are just overwhelming stage productions that so many musicals. This is a much more intimate musical, correct?
Well, you know, we have a cast of 18 and a band of 9. So it's not really a small musical. The set designer came up with this beautifully fluid way of transitioning from scene to scene. So it may, you know, it doesn't just drop a set in and then, you know, there'll be a house, and then you'll be in the outdoors, and then you'll be somewhere else. It's largely imagined, so it might look that way, but actually, it's a pretty big musical.
Okay. I always, when I listen to the music to it, I think of it more of a personal story where,
yes,
as opposed
is.
To some supernatural event that's going on. And if you see the big musical, the Andrew Lloyd Webber's and the thing, there's this monstrous event happening.
Right.
Nothing wrong with it, but this is a much more personal feel to me when I listen to the music.
Pardon me?
No, I just say when I listen to the music, that's what I get from it. I've not seen, and I've heard about and I've seen bits and pieces of the set that spins around with the band and those things like that, which is just, this must be, you must just be, when I listen to it, I'm thinking, what would the creators, what would Edie and Steve, and of course everybody else involved, what do you think, not just when you're watching it, but if you sit back and listen to the soundtrack, it just must be this overwhelming feeling of, look at how far we've come from this tiny little concept to what's going on now.
It's very thrilling to, well, in my case, write a song on the banjo and hear it be played by an orchestra and suddenly have, you know, the melodies be enforced 5 times by, you know, a cello, a viola, a violin, and the banjo. You know, it's quite an experience because, you know, your melodies then also have to hold up from the assault of the orchestra.
Oh, yeah.
They can't be mediocre. So, but it is really also, you have such talent involved. The talent, as you know, in the singing of the songs and the playing of the songs. So it is a real thrill to hear the music that you compose in your living room being translated to an orchestra of 9 and a cast of 18.
It must just be at some point overwhelming. When you get through all the smiles and the teary eyes, it must be just overwhelming. We've said this already, but I just think it must be, knowing the fact that it starts out as this little germ of a conversation that you have with Edie to trade these bits of music back and forth, and those were like from kind of like bluegrass to Broadway almost, the path it took, and this sort of like it took on its own life. Well, we talked about this before, this thing developed, it was a baby that you were working on, and I don't know that you had a real choice about how to proceed once the ideas came about, certainly as far as getting it on stage, but it seems to me that this whole Bright Star concept kind of took on its own life force and just kind of pulled you all that way.
Yes, it's, you know, it's like somebody said to me that when you're doing a movie, it's just like a train that's suddenly set in motion. And if you're not ready, it doesn't matter because the brain is still going. it's like moving a circus around.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So this thing gets kicked up, and I think that you were already before the second album. When I say the first and second, meaning the ones that you and Edie kind of put up. Certainly before So Familiar, this was already a done piece. You'd worked it out. You'd gone to San Diego, and then you released the second album, So Familiar.
Well, there were a lot of changes between San Diego and next time we did it was at the Kennedy Center.
That's right.
We just discovered refinements and new songs, and you really just at night when you're in San Diego, you can just lie in bed and think through the musical and think what could actually improve this thing, and that's what happened.
Well, then how do you reach this decision? Then I will let you be for the rest of the day. How do you reach the decision to say, okay, now it's time. We've done enough of this. Now let's do the cast album, which is what we're initially talking about, due out in the end of May. How does that come about?
Like I say, it's a train. You don't tell it when you want to record it. It tells you, meaning you can't record it before the musical has opened because the musical keeps changing. And I kept thinking, no, I think we're pretty solid. And then we did change it. So actually it was smart that we waited and recorded it. Now it does accurately reflect the show. But I'm just saying that, it would be better to have the album out the night it opens, but you just can't because you don't know what's the finished product is going to be.
Let me ask you this. How many times have you actually seen it live? And I mean on Broadway. On Broadway, you don't go every night.
Oh, on Broadway, I'd say at least 50 times.
Oh, gosh, okay.
Yeah.
I just.
There were 4 weeks of reading,
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, so that 8 shows times 4, whatever that is today, in today's world. I don't know if it's still 32, it might have changed. and I saw every one of those shows, and then you see it after it opens. So, yeah, you're there. I can count all the times in San Diego and Washington, D.C.
In that pre, that 4 weeks you're talking about, are things still open to change?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes. That's what previews are for.
As it's running now, do you envision any more nuances being changed or anything being
changed? No, you don't really change it after it's open, even if there's a few tweaks I'd like to make. But it's hard on the actors. They've worked so hard for all these years, and then you suddenly start calling them in the afternoon, let it be.
Yeah.
The next iteration could have little tiny changes. We have no major changes to make anyway.
Well, listen, I really enjoy knowing in conversations with you about how this thing developed, having listened to both of the albums and then listened to this soundtrack, which, again, I'm streaming it off of a source on NPR because it comes out on the 27th. It's really a lot of fun to think about all those changes, how this thing developed, and now to get this really, really nice, big, Broadway vocals, all of these huge voices. I've enjoyed it immensely, being able to just kind of let it run.
Well, thanks very much. We really enjoyed it, too.
Okay. Well, listen, I'll let you get back. I know you're in the middle of a lot of things, and I appreciate your time.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
I'll talk to you. Bye. Thanks so much, Steve Martin, for being around, being available to chat again about what's going on in the world with Steve and Edie Brickell as this Bright Star musical just keeps rolling along. All of the reviews, if you haven't been paying attention, all of the reviews, and I will get the New York Times on Sunday and read the article about Carmen Cusack. All of the reviews are positive. There are awards nominations. There were 7 Drama Desk nominations that happened to come out the day that Steve and I recorded. That was just a couple of days ago. So things are always fluid, I guess, in the world of Broadway.